Hi, I'm Jay.
And I'm Christopher.
Christopher?
What's with Christopher. That?
That's my full name.
Nobody uses your full name.
No, everyone calls me Gigantor.
Oh, fair. Oh, yeah.
And we're the Grumpy Dungeon Masters.
Damn it, you cut me off. Oh, well. Yeah, we're Grumpy. Why, hello, Craig.
Where were you last night, Craig?
What were you up to? Where were you between the hours of 11:30 p.m.?
Were you reading this Dungeon Master Guide?
Hi, guys. And by guys, I mean, yeah, Chris and anyone else who's listening.
Hi, everybody.
That means you, FBI.
They're listening for sure.
Mm-hmm. So, all right, let's talk about this writing course that you got me roped into. So it's the RPG Writer Workshop, where they teach you how to write modules to get published on DM's Guild, RPG Drive-Thru, and one other location that I forgot about.
It's hosted, I think, this year by DM's Guild.
Lady who is sort of running it, she's published. She's actually, I think, the person who wrote the Icewind Dale book recently.
She co-authored that, yeah. Trying to remember her name.
I can find it, I'm sure. It doesn't matter. Hold on. Alicia. What's her last name? Curses. Well, thank you, Alicia. We're enjoying this.
Her name is Ashley Warren.
Oh, okay. Alicia's a different instructor. My apologies. But thank you either way.
I saw it just to kind of get an idea of what it entails to create a work professionally and publish it. This so far has been a very beginner's course on this is how Word would work and this is how we do our templates and stuff. And while you find that annoying, being me coming from my profession, that's just another day in the office. So it's interesting to see that what they've been doing is how I've been handling a lot of how I used to write my materials and my one shots and just how I write my process. And it kind of matches up a little bit. And I'm looking forward to using the information they provide about how to get published into the DM's Guild, because I know it's just as easy as writing something up and publishing it. I know it's just that easy, but I didn't want that level of product. I wanted a very here is a finished book we could possibly print out. So I needed all the art and all the instruction and all the templates and all that other stuff. And that's what I really wanted to get out of this course, as along with other tips and tricks for writing. And so far, they've been able to provide a lot of stuff, and I'm hoping to see a lot more from their side on how they write and manage and get things published and
for
writing.
You, this is more, like you said, it's sort of your profession to do this. For me, the only thing that I've really pulled from this so far that was been useful was all the resources, because sort of the process to get it published is what I am unfamiliar with. And that to me is incredibly useful, having that information. The other aspects of it, of actually how to write a module, one, I've read hundreds of modules from beginning to end. I've run dozens of them. And I've been running D&D on and off for 30 years nearly at this point. So my writing process to create stuff is very ingrained. It's not likely to change. And then, mind you, they haven't really thrown anything out there to make it change. But things that they have mentioned, like the mood boards and the playlist, things of that nature, I don't utilize and never will. For other people who might be new to writing modules from scratch, that might be incredibly useful. Or people whose brains just work different than mine, it might be useful.
Yeah, but that's where a lot of it's coming from, for at least this first week of the product. And I'm sure the second week will be much different.
Yeah, I mean, it's a month-long course, and we're on week one. So I expect to see some more stuff that I will find useful. Before we got on here, we were talking about something.
We were talking about what we were going to write our one-shots around.
That's right.
I have Yurg running a very generic one shot for one for a setting that can kind of run anywhere. I'm going to try to keep it the same, but at the same time, I feel that I need to find a city or town that works well for it. In order for me to find a city or town that works well for it, I need to find a set of monsters that will work for what I want. And that's kind of like where I usually start most of my creative process. I start with the monsters and then I move forward from there. So like if I wanted to create like a 1-3 one shot, level 1-3 one shot, I would, you know, look at the monsters that are between levels 1 and 3, beasts, goblins, kobolds, you know, a hobgoblin or two, and, you know, maybe right around that. I'm shooting for more the 3-7 range, so I'm looking for things like around level 5.
So we actually have the same process for that. For me, when it comes to creating modules, I start with the monsters first. I will flip through manuals. I'll see something that looks neat, something I've never run before, and then I'll build around that. The one that I'm going to be writing is sort of based around a Kraken. I've run stuff around Krakens before, and that's nothing new or interesting, but I was flipping through the Volo's guide, and I came across the Kraken Priest. And it's in the level range of where my players are currently at, so I thought I would build something sort of based off of that.
Yeah, I actually thought about doing something like that too with a Kraken at first, because the disease that shall not be named, I was actually going to run a Kraken storyline with this, a bunch of lizard folk that were secretly trying to summon a Kraken and use it to, you know, destroy a coastal town on the Sword Coast.
And
but with
now,
those plans
now,
scrapped.
Yeah, now that I have mentioned the Kraken Priest, I have to make certain that I run this for my players before we release this episode.
part of the process too is actually playtesting. So when we get down to the playtesting aspect of this, you know, running across your players is the first playtest before publishing.
Yeah.
So
yeah, I mean, that's fine. I just have to make sure we get it before this goes online.
Just introduce the villain right from the get-go.
Yeah, that's exactly how you start an encounter. This is the bad guy. You're going to hate him. Oh, well, shit, he's dead when he was trying to monologue in the opening stanza.
There's a video game like that from like the 90s, I think. I think it was called Two Cities. And when you start the game, you get through the very beginning of the tutorial and you run outside the first village. The end boss is literally standing like outside the village and you can aggro him. And when you aggro him, the guards aggro on him because he's attacking you as the player. And the guards will eventually spawn enough times and swarm him and kill him. And that's just the end of the game right then and there, because he's dead and the game doesn't have to happen. You get the ending cutscene and everything's
done. Yeah, I never heard about that. Final Fantasy, the original one, is actually kind of that way. You know, the very first boss that you fight in game is also the very last boss that you fight in the game.
Yep. You start the game by beating the end boss.
Yeah. Yeah, pretty much.
Two Worlds. It's called Two Worlds. That's what the game is.
I remember that game. That's not from the 90s, though. That was maybe a decade ago.
Okay.
I remember when it came out, but I never actually played it.
Yeah, so there's a speed running category just for beating that game as fast as possible.
That's how you do it. You just aggro that guy. Let the guards kill him. Victory.
I mean you could definitely do that with your campaign. Just introduce him right from the get-go.
No, and I know my players well enough. Like they will literally just try to murder him immediately.
Well, you could always just put him like right behind an acid pit and take care of your players that way.
So have you ever, speaking of things that you really probably shouldn't be killing in the beginning, have you ever as a DM thrown something at your players that they're not supposed to fight and they decide they're going to fight it anyway?
No.
I'll take that brief silence as a
well,
no.
Well, I was thinking about that because in the the beginnings of fourth edition, the very like first campaign setting for Fall Crest, there's a dark knight on a horseback that's supposed to like loom over the players from a distance as they fight the first goblin ambush. And they're supposed to like, you know, use that as a hook to, you know, find out who this dark knight was and chase him down. And
right. So for the next five levels, that's the guy we're trying to find.
Right. I was trying to remember if any of the players that I ran through the Fall Crest book ever actually tried that. And none actually did.
Yeah. It's just this conversation brought me to one of the things that DMs will occasionally do is the whole railroading aspect, you know, where you sort of force your players to do something. And Johnny, our the other game master that I also run games for, long time ago, he was still, I wouldn't say he wasn't new to DMing, but he was new to running the group that we're in at the moment. So myself and Drew and all of the other players, he was new to that group. And he didn't know how we were going to handle the situations. He expected us to do it like previous groups. So he puts an NPC that the other players, that his previous players had met before, and they hated the guy, but they just sort of left him alone. Us, we're a lot more aggressive about stuff like that. So he sends this guy after us, and the guy wasn't there to kill us. He was just there to sort of piss us off. And we literally spent that entire evening trying to kill this guy who's like, I don't know, 8 levels higher than us. We're just chasing him down the road, and finally he just had to have that NPC leave. That entire campaign going forward, we constantly messed with that guy. We hated that guy. He just made an NPC super freaking unlikable.
Yeah.
So it became our life goals to kill this asshole.
Well, in 5th edition, you can definitely introduce a boss early, and you could run into the problems of having the players kill them too early.
Mm-hmm.
Like, there's a start of a Waterdeep campaign where you have to go steal Xanathar's goldfish, for example. And, you know, the players could actually go fight Xanathar if they wanted to, and they're like level 1 or 3.
Yeah, so that's just instant death.
So you're supposed to use the goldfish to, like, if you fire an I-beam, I'm going to kill the goldfish. And Xanathar's supposed to be, no, don't do it. But, you know, it's the pull holder. He's gonna kill you.
Yeah, I'm super careful about introducing players to things that are way beyond their power levels, because you know, some players they don't understand to run away, and I know a lot of players who don't understand the idea of running away from situations. They'd much rather stand and fight, and sometimes that's a bad idea.
They're definitely rewarded for standing and fighting in 5th edition. There were a couple times where I ran an encounter against my party, like they're level 3 or 4 total, and there's a level 6 or 7 CR monster as a single boss. And because of just like the action economy of the players, they can just destroy the high level CR monster.
Yeah.
So you have to go really crazy, like CR 15 to really...
Right, that's what I'm talking about. Even introducing them to NPCs that are, you know, 10 levels above them, I mean, that can be risky. You never know what your players are going to do. And they might, Lord knows, I've had enough players who try to pilfer the pockets of anybody and everybody.
That never happens in my games, and I don't know why.
You need worse players.
No, I don't. My players have other problems. Not the current ones, but other previous ones have had problems. Like, it's my turn. I'm gonna cast this spell. What's that spell you're casting? I'm gonna cast Healing Word at level 8. You're level 3. How can you do that? Oh, sorry, I didn't mean 8. I mean, I'm going to cast at level 4. I'm going to use all my spell slots and cast this level 1 spell at level 4. That's you can't do that. You can just cast at level 1. Well, how does a cleric work again?
You can keep those players. I'll pass. No, thank you. No, thank you.
Your players get to be creative and pill for pockets, and mine have to not understand what spell slots are.
With the campaign that I just started up, I wasn't trying to talk him out of playing what he wanted to play, but I ended up accidentally talking him out of playing it. He wanted to play a thief who was a member of the Thieves Guild. Now, I hadn't really thought too much about the Thieves Guild in the campaign setting, so I figured, okay, well, give me a couple days and I'll think about how to go about this. And I know this player well enough. It's the same one I talk about all the time. I knew his plan was to walk around picking pockets. That was it. So I explained to him very quickly, that's fine, you can play this, but I am not going to sidetrack the campaign just so you can go pilfer things. So then he comes back with an assassin character instead. I was like, okay, fine. At least.
So now he spends the entire session walking around assassinating people. Good.
Yeah, well, no, he's not an evil character, so he's not going to be murdering everybody. It's, you know, just the assassin archetype. So,
no, this assassin's not an evil person. He's a good assassin. He does good assassinations.
It's like I said, it is just the archetype of assassin, which basically just means you get a kit of skills, of which most honestly. So the big benefit in the early levels of playing an assassin is assassinate. I think that's what it's called. It's basically at third level you get it. If you attack something in the surprise round and hit, it's an auto critical. Which is an absurd amount of damage. You know, at third level, you know, you get the D8 and then you get your 2D6 sneak attack damage and then that's doubled. So, yeah, I mean, it's possible to do 40 damage or something at that level. That being said, the surprise round is fucking stupid. I don't like the way they do it in 5th edition.
Really? Because I love it. I think it's the best.
It is very DM decision oriented. It's not a set rule. It's, does anything see the party coming? You know, and that's, I've ran into that a couple of times this past weekend with him playing that character, and it's just, it complicated the shit out of things because I then have to make all these determinations whether or not anybody in the party has been spotted.
Well, that's the whole point of the surprise round on 5e is they took that away from the DM. You don't have to worry about that anymore.
No, it is a problem. So it's easier to figure out if a single character hasn't been spotted than it is an entire party. Like it only works if it's party based. If so Drew, the player, if he's not seen, doesn't mean squat. If that giant barbarian is spotted, well, you know, surprise round's over.
No, it's not.
That's how that works, according to how I went online, read all about it. If anyone is spotted, no surprise round.
No. So if your characters are going for a surprise round, okay, they're going to jump on a bandit camp. Okay. You can have the players that have to know, like, you send the stealthy characters in first. You're not going to send the plate wielder in to get a better position on the bandit camp. Okay. So, yeah, he's going to have to pass a couple sneak checks to get up to sneak stealth checks to get closer to the bandit camp. But let's say him and the ranger do it. So they're close. Okay. So they're just a move distance away from, you know, being in the camp doing what they want or whatever. Mm-hmm. And everybody else is two moves away. The bandits aren't going to notice the guys that are 120 feet away or 60 feet away.
Yeah. But then you as the rogue, you are putting yourself at extreme freaking risk doing it that way because you are separated from the party.
Right. Know. But with how the surprise round works, they're not. Because all they have to do is then jump out and initiate and start initiative, okay? Assuming that they got to the edge of the bandit camp to initiate the surprise round. So then they jump out to you guys roll initiative, and you got to hope you're up to the initiative die at that point in time. But assuming he has high initiative, he gets to then move into the bandit camp, do his assassinate or whatever, and get his way out. No one else in the bandit camp are going to be able to do anything for that surprise round, because that's just how it works in 5e. They are surprised, so they don't get their turn. So the two stealth characters get in there, start unloading from the brush or assassinating a cleric that's sitting on the outskirts of the camp. The other group spends their surprise round running into the camp and taking positions. The other people that are getting surprised are just essentially stunned for that round. They can't do anything.
Right.
So it doesn't matter if the plate guy is, double move behind. There's no need for him to do the check unless he's going to get closer to the camp, and that's just stupid. So I still see fourth edition was terrible. But like,
I don't remember what surprise was in third edition. I think surprise was individual based, not group based.
It still is individual based. So when it comes to the monster's initiative, let's say that they actually rolled high on initiative. Okay. Mm-hmm. They are no longer surprised for that surprise round. Okay. So they don't get you don't get advantage on attacking them, but their turn was, they just became unsurprised. So they're still just sitting there or whatever. So it really sucks when you roll all super low in your initiative, but he's a rogue, so he should be pretty high,
Yeah, as well, I think assassins get bonuses to that to go
before it. The whole aspect of the surprise round where the monsters just don't act on this first turn and the players get an entire round to do whatever they want to the monsters at advantage is fantastic. And fourth, it was terrible because you did it individually between the monsters and everybody. But fifth has been great.
I have no context for fourth edition on how it worked. Fifth edition just seems very... I don't know. I like hard, solid numbers rules. Third edition had that with surprise. I can't recall what it was. I'd have to actively go back and look, but I remember it worked really well. And this is, I don't know, it's very DM discretion on stuff.
I get a lot of players who try to do that first, like, I'm going to fireball the camp as the start.
Mm-hmm.
And what I do in that situation is I let them do the fireball in, but then there's no surprise round.
Yeah, if somebody's trying to fireball in the camp, I would do the standard perception checks. They would have to make a stealth check, and if they are not spotted, I would allow them to throw the fireball first. They would effectively get an attack pre-initiative, and then we would go into initiative.
Right, that's how I still handled that situation. But when you explain to them how initiative or surprise round works in 5e, where they will get an entire round, they seem to basically be more strategic in how they approach the situation.
Yeah.
Because I tend to find out that a lot of players and a lot of DMs don't know how 5th edition surprise round works.
No, but this is the first time I've ever used it this past weekend. And the only reason I used it was because of the assassin.
So what happened?
I made the entire party make stealth checks because they were moving in as a party. So now I tend to do, if I do sort of group stealth checks. So say the passive perceptions of the creatures is a 10. So, as long as they roll a total on stealth check or an average above 10, then they're fine. Like I allow the whole group to sneak in.
Okay.
Conveniently enough, every single person in the party rolled like 15s or higher on stealth checks. So it made it real simple for that situation. And they pretty much rolled in, mopped up, in like two rounds. So,
yeah. So the whole kick in the door surprise round tactic works pretty well in 5th edition because the kick in the door is the initiative call, essentially. The monsters are surprised, so all the monsters are stunned for that one round, essentially.
Yep.
Very few monsters have any idea of, warning sense or anything like that to protect them from a surprise round. So, the players getting to the door to then basically SWAT it,
in essence. Well, this was an outdoor scenario. which made it that honestly, that's what made it more complicated. If it was like in a dungeon or something, that just feels more natural to me for people to be sneaking. But daytime out in the woods, I mean, I guess, you are sneaking in the woods, but it just still felt a little off for me.
Yeah, in that situation, I would say,
it's a line of sight issue. I mean, daytime, geez, man, you can see a long freaking ways. So,
well, I mean, you still got lots of cover. I mean, if you're a plate wielder or bad at stealth, then you stay 60 feet away.
Yeah,
stay off the board in a sense, and let the stealth characters get in there and kind of do their thing. Surprise round is still murder.
I think it would be just easier for the assassin thing to not have to worry about the surprise round. If you make an attack before somebody goes on an initiative, then they should just give it that. It shouldn't be on a surprise round. Would that make the assassin even better? Yes, but truthfully, I don't think it's that big of a deal.
But it's real easy to do surprise round in essence, especially when you're going through like a manor or something like that.
Well, I mean, then there's always the issue that I run into a lot of times of sound, like combat's noisy. You know this, we all know this, but you'll have a dungeon that's laid out where each room is, 40 feet apart. So you have to sort of set in things into motion where if one room gets into a fight, the next room piles in, it complicates combat in general.
Yeah, it definitely can. I mean, there definitely are times where you pull multiple rooms and stuff like that, so you don't get the multiple surprise rounds, but there are definitely ways to especially if they get the first surprise round off and the assassin kills a player or kills a big NPC, and then the range people take out a couple people as well too, and that surprise round, then yeah, they made noise, but they didn't make too much noise. But then if they slogged it through 45 rounds, then yeah, they're going to make a lot of noise. Because, if they take them out in 3 rounds, that's...
Yeah, 18
seconds. Yeah. I don't think a room 40 feet away is going to really care. They're being noisy again. How smart are the monsters?
Well, I mean, just think about it. If you say you're in your house... I don't know how close your neighbor's house is, but just assume your neighbor is right next door, 40 feet away. So some dude comes in there, hell, a couple of dudes come in there with swords. Your neighbor and his wife pull out swords and they all start swinging and yelling. That's noisy. You're going to, I hear arguments from people across the street, when they out in their yard yelling at each other. So,
yeah, but the question is how quickly do you respond to that? So, even if my daughter's crying from the other room...
Oh, I'm in Alabama. I don't respond to that at all.
Right, so you don't... And that's exactly my point. You don't respond to that at all, so then guys come in through your house.
Yeah, but if you are living in a cave with a pack... say you're a pack of 50 gnolls all living in a cave together as a clan, and you hear combat coming from the other room, you might actually respond to that.
It depends. Are they noisy goblins?
Yeah,
and as long as the players aren't screaming at the top of their lungs like "death to all goblins," then
Yeah, yep, that's fair.
I mean, it really kind of depends. I usually, base it off how the players are handling their situations and how noisy they are. My wife with her paladin recently had a flame tongue, warhammer, and she had to scream gumdrop in order for it to turn on. So she told me that's how she has to turn it on. So I was like, okay, we have to scream gumdrop in the middle of this dungeon, the top of your lungs, every time you want to turn it on per your rules. And she did. Everybody knows they're in there though. So
in the pirate campaign that I was playing, and one of the other players is playing a warforged who has a tick that anytime he speaks, He speaks at like Samuel Jackson voice, like always just yelling. So, he can't speak any other way. I think we finally got that fixed, but for about the first 6 or 7 levels, he always had to be yelling when talking. So trying to stealth into any scenario, we had to make sure that he already knew what the plan was, because it's not like he can whisper any instructions to us afterwards.
Yeah. That's great.
Yeah, that guy always makes fun characters.
My wife had to make a new character for Tomb of Annihilation, and this time she made a dragonborn wizard. And she chose the chef background, the failed merchant background.
What is that from?
I think it's Saltmarsh. I don't remember.
Oh, okay.
So she's a failed merchant, and the reason why she's a failed merchant is she decided to open up a barbecue pit at some unnamed elven city, and they didn't like the fact that she had a barbecue pit, because the way she made the barbecue was that she would basically skewer the little animals and then breathe fire on them to toast them.
That sounds unsanitary. That's how you get the COVID. That's how you get the Rona, man.
and that's why she's a failed merchant. So she immediately pulls out some rat and cooks the rat for the other players. It's like, here, you want to try some? And they're like, no. And then one of the person's like, well, I'm an aquatic druid, so have you ever tried fish? And she's like, no, but I got a frog. She pulls out a frog. It's a gung on a stick. So she's like, here, have a frog.
Oh, that's wonderful.
Yeah, it's her best character yet, in my opinion.
Yeah, we had the same guy who was playing the Warforged. He used to have a character in one of my other campaigns where he was playing a lizard man who had a finger bag that he carried around with him for snacks. You know, just anytime they would kill whatever, he would take fingers from it and just sort of tote those around. I mean, it's not cannibalism. He wasn't eating lizard men, so. So speaking, you before this, you wanted to talk about acid and failure. I hear the laugh. You have to tell me the story.
So we're playing Tomb of Annihilation, and spoilers for anyone that don't want to know anything about Tomb of Annihilation. But there's a room, and there's a lot of monsters in this particular room. But before you get into this room, there is an acid pit that you could fall into. And I'm going to be very vague about that because the lead up is pretty obvious and it's pretty easy to fall into the acid pit because no one's really going to look for the acid pit where it is. We had this acid pit. The first player didn't fall into it that triggered it. He was able to dexterity save and grab a hold of a ledge. The second player decided to do a standing jump over the gap of the acid pit. Which I had to look up real quick as to, you know, how far can you go on your standing jump, and it's half your strength. If you do a running jump, it is your strength modifier. So her strength was 13. So she did a long jump, she would have cleared it easy, but she did the standing long jump, so she made it 6 feet, so she fell in the acid. They got her out of the acid. She lost a lot of her stuff in that process. And the other players were able just to clear it easy. So our aquatic druid, though, decided to stay on the opposite side of the acid pit with an NPC they had found in the dungeon. So combat kind of breaks out. Things are going down. Through circumstances, you know, well within their control, they've made an enemy out of this NPC. NPC doesn't want to have any problems, doesn't want to do anything with them, just kind of following them around like, you do you, I'll be me, I'll stand here and wait. They're getting to a very critical moment in the fight in this room. The aquatic druid is standing right in front of the acid pit so she can see into the room and like heal people from a distance. The NPC is standing right behind her.
Yep.
I ask her what her passive insight is. It's passive perception is. It's 19.
Wow.
I roll my stealth check. I rolled a 19, plus the NPC's modifiers, plus the fact that they're a doppelganger. I gave them a surprise on that attack, and I rolled the attack, and I got a crit.
Oh, no.
So I explained to them, like, it's, you know, you see this blue arm just stick right through you like a sword, and does, I think it was like 47 damage or something to them in that one attack.
Oh, see, and I thought he was going to push them into the acid pit.
No, I did the stab first. That was the following round.
Oh, okay. Okay.
They decided to basically stand there, turn around, heal the players, and then flip the NPC off because they still had some health left. and they could take another blow.
That's not the correct way to do that. Especially if you're a druid, I would have shapeshifted into a bird and gotten across the pit.
So, that's what they decided to do. I said, all right, give me your athletics check versus, or dexterity check versus my athletics check to get pushed into the pit. Their total was 10. My total was 11.
Oh, no.
And they got pushed into the pit. That first round of acid was 72 acid damage, I think it was.
Oh, my God.
They were instantly unconscious.
Oh, yeah.
Another player that had spider climb ran down to the bottom of the acid pit, popped a heal into it, so she, when it was their turn, they didn't take the two
death
failures. Yeah. And, you know, they had to spend the entire next round in the acid pit, then the player was able to grab them, pull them out, take some acid damage in the process, but they were able to basically, they got like a 26 on their athletics check to pull them out of the pit and drag them up. So, in that same time, the doppelganger was able to run away. More of the fight's still going on. Chaotic fight. There were fucking 10 monsters in that encounter versus a party of 5, and half the party was stuck in another object the entire time. So it was, this fight took the entire night.
Yeah, that happens sometimes.
Yeah.
Happens a lot less with 5th edition than it did in 3rd, but it still happens.
Yeah. So the fight's still going on. The aquatic druid decides the best place to be is to go back across the acid pit with Misty Step to basically make sure they don't get hit by any of the monsters in that room, because the monsters would just obliterate her if they did. So then I asked her what her passive perception was at the end of her round. Well, it turned out their passive perception was high enough to notice a rat sneaking up behind her. So she turned around, saw it was a doppelganger. Doppelganger did the push. And that time the doppelganger was just super successful, pushed into the acid pit. She's in the acid pit a second time. And she's still, you know, it still hasn't been her round. The other healer tosses her a heal again from a distance. And like, that's the best I can do. Where she was in the acid pit, it came her turn again. And I think they were only able to get like one hit point or something like that. So
just enough to prevent the you know, death failures.
Right. But the acid pit was doing enough. It was going to just, if they rolled high, that she was just going to die. And she's like, okay, well, is it possible for me to bonus action Misty Step just out of the acid pit? I'm like, well, the acid starts as it hits at the start of your turn. Now, how she saved it was, it's like, but I am resistant to acid, which is why she, you know, survived the fall from the get-go. So I was like, all right, because you're resistant, you get your bonus action, but you won't get your resistance to the acid damage. And you have to use Misty Step to a place that you can see. And so with you flailing around the acid, you could see the roof, the ceiling of the place. So you can see points of space above, but you can't really judge where you're going to go.
I already see how this goes.
So there was two spaces of, so there's 2x2 square of acid and then a 1x2 like stone on top of it. It's like, you can Misty Step as your bonus action before the acid burns through you because of your resistance alone. But you're going to have to roll D6. And I was like, on my tabletop was like, this is 1, this is 2, this is 3, this is 4, this is 5, this is 6. So 3 and 6, you pass. And he rolled, he got a 3. So he got out of the acid pit. But I said that all of the gear that she had been eaten away because they spent so long in the acid. Anything that was magic is probably the bottom of the acid pit. You know, they were very sad because this was a very personal character to them. They didn't want it to die in the acid, but
yeah,
that doppelganger, man, we'll bring him back.
For sure. Yeah, definitely would not have gone back over where the guy was at. Like I see why you mentioned, you know, failure with acid. I mean, that's a poor player choice.
Well, it kind of was and it kind of wasn't. It was either stay on the other side of the acid pit with the 10 monsters that the team have been fighting now for at least 6-7 rounds that they have not taken any down with, or risk that the doppelganger still on the other side of the acid pit.
No, there's one obvious choice. All right, so you have already been skewered by this guy and then shoved into an acid pit, and you're over there by yourself. And that's the kicker, by yourself. I mean, rule number one, don't split the party.
Right.
I mean, if you're going to be over there with the other 10 monsters, yes, you may get dropped, you may get killed, but you're right there with the party. Makes it a lot easier for cure wounds, healing word. Like, there's so many ways to get somebody up in that situation. But if you are across that pit, healing word, that's about it. So.
Well, they're a healing druid, so she has like some aquatic thing that runs around.
But that's also assuming that you don't get shoved into the acid pit a second time.
The best part is, too, is that like they had multiple constructs get shoved into the acid pit as well.
I mean, I love Tomb of Annihilation, even though I have never gotten to play through the whole thing, but I just love all of the stories because I've been hearing stories about this thing for as long as I've been playing D&D. And just, I hear stories like this and it makes me understand the lethality of it. Makes me want to build something like that myself.
It'd be really hard because I think for all the death that Tomb of Annihilation causes, Tomb of Annihilation feels very fair. Like levels 1 through 3, they just blew through. There were a couple instances where there, if they had made better choices, they wouldn't have died, but it was all on the players. Now they're at level 4, about to go down to level 5. It's flipped a switch. Now it doesn't really feel fair. Where, like, everything here is like, okay, you fall into this acid pit. That's 66 damage on average. You're dead. Yeah. All right. And the room is full of 10 monsters that you can't handle that are large and greater. It's still just fair enough. Yeah, like, they were successful. No one died. Yeah. But level 5 is worse. Level 6 is the end. And that is just unbalanced.
I used to know a dungeon master, and mind you, this is a long time ago when I was 15, 16 years old. The guy was a lot older than I was, but he had been playing the same campaign for 10 plus years at that point. And it was one single dungeon. And he showed me the binder that he had on this thing. And it was a massive, just thick binder of a single dungeon, level by level. And at that point, I think it was around 100 floors of a dungeon that he had put together. And just, I always wanted to run through something like that.
Yeah.
And it would be so cool to actually build that. You know, it's just an underground world.
Well, that's Dungeon the Mad Mage, essentially.
Yeah, basically. It's just that level of creativity. Yeah, this is somebody who must have, I would imagine he had plenty of free time. Although this is back in the 90s, so it's not like you're sitting on the internet all day or flipping through Facebook.
Well, that's even more impressive because all you had was your materials. You didn't have any dungeon makers or...
Oh, yeah, it was all done by hand, yeah.
Yeah, graph paper and pen, just go at it.
Yep.
I actually found my binder, my graph paper and pen stuff that I had from a long time ago where I crafted out what will be my homebrew campaign world. When I first started doing 4th edition, I had actually went through and just built all the rooms, all the dungeons for the final dungeon and a bunch of other places because I was running it as a one-shot. And this is before I knew anything about time management. The game took 12 hours. We did it in a single day.
Oh, I remember those days. I've done 16-hour straight game sessions before. So.
I would love to do that.
I don't think I can anymore, but back when you're 18 or whatever, that's all you do. It's pretty easy.
I would love to. I mean, I can just picture it now. Like, you go rent a hotel room or something like that.
Yeah.
And it has a big enough place where you just set down a TV, load your maps up, sit on comfortable couches and chairs, and just do it all day. And
see, you do your brain works so much differently than mine. Immediately, you're like, okay, you set up a TV, you have your maps. I'm sitting here thinking of, okay, I have a binder full of stuff, and my maps are all hand drawn.
Well, I mean, like a big TV too. Like you can see it from the couch, and like you use like little, like those long war sticks that they have for pushing around miniatures. Like I'm gonna move here.
Yeah. It's a. I don't know why I've just done it so long that way. You know, like even when I write up campaigns, I had most of the campaign stuff I've written has been by hand. Like I didn't use Word or anything like that for it. I'm only just now starting to utilize the online stuff because I have to because of the coronavirus. I mean, seriously.
You messaged me like, I'm starting to use Google Docs. I was like, great. Welcome to 2005.
I mean, I've been using, you know, Word and whatnot for forever, but I don't use it for writing my D&D games. My D&D games have always just been handwritten. It's just a thing that I've always done. It's how I learned to do it. So.
Yeah, one thing I always normally did is I always used Word, and I would throw things into a Word document and start filling out an outline that I had. And one of the things that the workshop once wanted us to do is like to use OneNote. And I'd never used OneNote before because I had Notepad. But I started using OneNote, and it's pretty neat. I like it. I'm going to try to use that a lot in this throughout this month, essentially.
But yeah, like even the companies that I had worked for, yeah, like the cartography company that I was working for previously, like they didn't utilize Google Docs or anything like that. We had an in-house system that we utilized for the sharing of files. I don't remember what it was at this point, but so Google Docs, something completely new to me.
Yep.
I mean, it's useful. It's easy. Yeah, it's easy. I mean, it's not difficult to figure this stuff out if you have any online or computer skills whatsoever. But yes, we were speaking of mapping. At some point, we need to actually talk about the different mapping stuff that's out there for creating maps. With me having to do everything now online, Dungeon Draft was amazing with finding that. It, along with Wonder Draft, has just made my life so much better. Because previously, when I was running stuff on Roll20, I would just Google maps, you know, download some random map that somebody else had made, and I would just run an adventure that way. But I like making my own stuff. I know you do too.
Yeah. Well, a lot of the stuff I do right now is just me find the map online and modify it to fit my needs with, I use Arkenforge for all that. But I'm looking forward to using, like, I think it's called Forge here in the future, because Forge is more of like an online platform of hosting games. Like there's like a board you can post like pictures and things to, like the handouts that you normally give players. You can post all that stuff there. The players could write notes there and keep track of things. And that's like just their place to keep all their data. And then they have a very interactive system for moving around characters and importing maps and stuff like that. And best of all, it imports your character from D&D Beyond, so you don't have to buy the materials a second time.
Yeah, see, that's the thing for you because of the D&D Beyond, and you've spent all that money into it. You're going to find ways to utilize it.
Right. So if, you know, which is why I don't use Roll20, because I'm not going to buy everything a third time.
Yeah, whereas me, I'm using Roll20 because it's free and it works really well. Yeah, like you were talking about allowing notes for players and things of that nature. Like they have places for all that. The free version of it has like a lot of drag and drops for character classes. Pretty much every magic, every one of the DMG's magic items is just drag and drop. All of the creatures from the monster manual for the most part. Yeah.
Yeah. And that's just not enough for what I want to do. Like if I want to run Tomb of Annihilation through that, I'd have to buy the Tomb of Annihilation book. I'd have to make sure I got the monster manual, the DM's guild, and then I'd have to have all the books for all the players. You're making special characters. Like I had a Tortola or Tortolan, whatever.
You don't have to have all of that. Like you can do it other methods. Like none of my players have any of the stuff on Roll20. They haven't paid a cent to use this thing. And yeah, maybe some of us will donate or whatever, but we haven't actually had to pay. And
yeah, but then it's also not interactive enough either for me. Like I can't draw sight lines and have moving objects and animated stuff. I just I felt very restricted with Roll20, yeah. And then I have to
buy stuff. It's actually really good with sight lines, but yeah, I mean animated stuff, you know, things like that. Yeah, it's definitely more complex to utilize it that way.
But I heard it's a great tool, and you know, if you're looking for a tool for the first time, go use it. You know.
Yeah, I mean it's not complicated to learn. That was a big thing for me, you know, because we had the two dungeon masters, and between the two of us, we were able to figure out pretty much everything we needed to know.
Yeah.
You know, one person figures out a little trick and they teach the other one.
That's how it was with me and my friend with Arcanforge. We basically just used that tool and shared information on how to use it, and then we figured out how it all works, and you know, here we are using it. And he's actually moved on to the Forge, and he showed me Forge, and now I'm going to move on to doing that too. And but probably after I have to stop running 750 games at a time.
Seems interesting. So one thing, actually backing way up to the RPG Writer Workshop that we were talking about, because they were giving a lot of resources, and one that I had never heard about that somehow skipped my site was the worldanvil.com. And did you see this thing?
No, I didn't.
Okay, well, I haven't had a chance to really go through it yet and figure it out. But it is a campaign manager where you create your campaign, maps, everything, and all detail it out, and it's all just sort of kept and built on this thing. So I might play with it some this week and let if it's really cool or not. Might be something to actually talk about later on.
Yeah, but that's what the Forge was as well. You build your campaign in that environment.
Okay, so I don't know squat about Forge other than the little images I've seen of you in it, but so it might be something like that. I don't know that you can run games online with it. I haven't delved that far into it, but it definitely allows you to build a campaign there from scratch.
Yeah, definitely sounds interesting, because that's all I'm really looking for at this point in time is tools to help me run my games better online.
Yeah, I mean, yeah, because you do pretty much run everything online, especially at this point. I mean, yeah, having access to better tools makes better games. Like Wonder Draft, hell, I was able to do maps of my entire world in less than an hour. I can put together a D&D adventure in 20 minutes or so on Dungeon Draft. You know, at least put a map together pretty easily utilizing it. So,
yeah. I made a mistake. It's not called Forge. It's called Foundry.
Foundry, okay. I'll have to look into that.
So Foundry is basically what I'm gonna start working towards for my games. The virtual tabletop for that. Because you build your campaign setting in it, and you import all your icons and stuff like that, and it's a very robust tool that, you know, you can have all of your stuff in one little place, so you can just run things. And the fact that it pulls from D&D Beyond is the selling point, and that I love it for that and that alone.
Oh, yeah, apparently I've been here before. You probably linked it to me at some point, and I looked at it. Yeah, the Foundry virtual tabletop. I think that's mostly it. I don't know that there's anything else we really need to talk about. Next time, I probably should start talking about my new campaign.
Sure, sounds great.
And all the craziness that is coming from that. Gnomish football. Yeah.
It's going to be like that old NES game where, like, if you run outside of the bounds, it explodes.
Yeah, that's possible. I don't see why not.
All right, so that's it for today.
Yeah, that's it for today. Bye, Craig.
Right. Bye, Craig.
Get Get out of here.
Leave.
Thanks for listening, people.
Bye.
Except you, Craig, or you, FBI.